case is United States v. Richard. I note again that Senior Judge Stuckey is here with us as the fifth judge, which we very much appreciate, and that Judge Sparks is participating by phone. Major Blatt, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
Major Spears, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Major Matt Blythe, and together with my co-counsel, Mr. Mark Ruger.
Would you please speak up a little?
Yes, Your Honor. Together with my co-counsel, Mr. Mark Ruger, we represent the appellant in this case, Aaron Basic Javon Richard. Chief Judge Olson, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Great.
Thank you, Your Honor. Clause 1 offenses under Article 134 require a direct and palpable prejudice to good order and discipline. The President mandates this strong language that this Court and the Supreme Court have both approved. And yet both at trial and on appeal, the government cannot point to a direct and palpable prejudice to good order and discipline. The government is bound by its charging decisions, and Aaron Richard's convictions are legally insufficient. I wanted to begin by emphasizing the difference between Clause 1 and Clause 2, and that flows from the language of the statute and what the President has given as guidance. Reasonably direct and palpable prejudice to good order and discipline. Palpable, that which is capable of being perceived by the senses, tangible. That contrasts starkly with Clause 2 offenses, service discrediting, that need only be of a nature to bring discredit upon the service. And this Court emphasized that distinction in Phillips when it recognized that public awareness was not required for a Clause 2 offense. And that flows from the nature of the statute, of the statute which says the conduct need only be of a nature.
Counsel, what are we to make of our predecessor court's decision in Caballero? So there, our court said, quote, the act of possessing a narcotic has been deemed directly prejudicial to good order and discipline and not merely a distant effect. End quote. So if there, the mere possession of an illegal drug, not the use, not the distribution, not the possession with intent to distribute, is in fact prejudicial to good order and discipline, why wouldn't it be that the mere possession of child pornography also would be deemed directly prejudicial to good order and discipline?
Yes, sir. I think the answer to that is this Court's jurisprudence has moved beyond Caballero. Looking,
have we ever overturned Caballero?
No, Your Honor, I'm not aware of
so
that.
So what are we to make of that fact? We've had this Court address this issue, and yet we've never overturned Caballero. It stands there.
Yes, Your Honor, I'm not aware of it being cleanly presented to this Court, the opportunity to overrule Caballero on that point. But I think the line of jurisprudence beginning with Medina and continuing through Fosler and through Phillips has emphasized the importance of each of the three clauses standing on their own. They're not interchangeable. Each needs to be independently pled and proven. And the notion that the act itself, the possession itself, would suffice to satisfy the terminal element is contrary to the notion that each has to be independently proven. There's no conclusive presumption that simply by virtue of committing the offense, that satisfies the terminal element.
And I understand your point, but you're not directly addressing Caballero. So is it your position that our court needs to overturn Caballero?
I'm not certain this court needs to. I don't know if that would be isolated to the way drug offenses used to be charged at that time, where now they're independent under Article 112A. That may be one distinction for this court to draw there. So I'm not sure that it needs to be directly overruled, but I'm also not sure that it has much force given the direction this Court's jurisprudence has taken. Returning to the difference between Clause 1 and Clause 2 offenses, we saw that play out at trial here, and it's critically important for notice, for pleading and proof. Here, Aaron Richard is on notice for child pornography offenses charged to the prejudice of good order and discipline. His defense counsel understandably waits for the government to put on any direct proof of that prejudice. Stands up during findings and says there has to be some military nexus, there has to be some connection. And all that the trial counsel comes back with is the act itself, possession of child pornography is prejudicial to good order and discipline.
Now, you referred to the military nexus and connection. Could it be argued that here the accused was not merely in a military status, but in fact used his military status in the course of sponsoring the 16-year-old foreign national onto an air base overseas, and importantly, that in sponsoring that person, was the accused was in fact making the security personnel at the gates complicit in his misconduct?
Well, yeah, I think that the role of security forces personnel at the gate is kind of incidental to the offense. And one important point to make here is that the offense doesn't actually begin.
Now, when you say incidental, but as in other instances where other people who are in the military learn of the offense, they're incidental, and yet that's sufficient for a Clause 1 violation, isn't it?
That would be, Your Honor, but again, the distinction there would be that they actually learned of the offense. Here, with the security forces members, they would be involved in bringing her onto base. However, the offense doesn't even begin until the recording button is pressed. There was nothing unlawful about bringing her onto the installation, bringing her to his dorm room, the actual sexual acts. None of those things were unlawful. It was only the act of recording that did it. Now, if security forces members or other personnel did become aware, that does implicate Clause 1 and can get the government closer to that point, but there's just no evidence in the record here to support that.
Counsel, can you define for me prejudice, right? We've got Article 134, two elements, right? You did a thing, the thing was bad. Here, the thing was bad, allegedly, because it was prejudicial to good order. What is prejudice? What is the noun that we can swap in for prejudice, that the thing that the government had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt?
I think, Your Honor, that Colonel Winthrop's formulation of injuriously affecting is a good concept to use as a placeholder for prejudice, that it actually has an impact on it. And so when I read prejudice, good order, and discipline, inserting injuriously affecting gets to the same place, I think.
So in your words then, and tell me if I'm wrong, the government has to show some injury, some harmful effect to prejudice or to good order.
Your Honor, we believe so, and there was an issue on whether or not awareness is required in order to meet that, but the key point is that there would have to be some impact on the military in order to suffice for a Clause 1 violation, and that goes back to the distinction with Clause 2, where awareness may not necessarily be required there. Here, in order to have a direct and palpable, going back to the language, direct and palpable, it would have to have some impact on the military. You could conjure a hypothetical where somehow there is an impact with no awareness. I'm not sure what that looks like. But to meet the plain language, it would have to be a direct and palpable impact. And our position is you have to show that impact, some impact on the military, in order to prove a Clause 1 offense. And I think it's important to emphasize what is not found on the facts here in some of the other cases. This was not depriving the military of a resource, not depriving the military of Airman Richards' time. No other service members were aware of what occurred. There's no readiness issue. At that point, to the Caldwell case, for the notion that the resources, a use of resources alone is insufficient to make out a claim under Clause 1. In the Caldwell case, we have an attempted suicide on base in the barracks, requires the immediate assistance of a senior NCO and corpsman. Medical resources are used. He misses time in pretrial confinement. None of those things sufficed in a guilty plea. This court had a substantial basis in law and fact to question the providence of that plea because of that. So I think that helps, it stands for the proposition that the use of military resources alone is not going to get to a Clause 1 violation. The government has a second theory whereby the harm to civilians can substitute for the prejudice to good order and discipline. I don't think there's any case that directly stands for that proposition. They cite to the Snyder case, where this court's predecessor, just a year after the code is established, is reviewing the state of the law, looking at Colonel Winthrop's writings on the predecessor to Article 134, where he did mention that good order could, in an offense against a civilian, include the harm to civilian. But the predicate for that is actual prejudice, good order, and discipline. actual prejudice to the military. That is an inescapable fact of any Clause 1 offense. It's actual prejudice, not simply harm to a civilian. And that, again, goes back to the language that's required for these offenses. It's direct, palpable, obvious injury, injuriously affecting. None of those things are found simply by virtue of there being harm to a civilian. Additionally, were this court to go in that direction, that would be contrary to the responsibility to this court's gatekeeper role for Article 134, whereby the Supreme Court has recognized that this court and the Court of Military Appeals before has a role in limiting the scope of Article 134, what this court has called an amorphous prosecutorial tool. And the notion that, untethered from the president's guidance or the statute, their civilian harm can suffice for prejudice to good order and discipline goes beyond what's permissible. So at the end, we ask the same basic question that the defense counsel asked during findings argument, which is, what is the direct connection to the military? What is the prejudice? How, within the record, within the charged time frame, was the military, was there any prejudice to good order and discipline? And we think that's simply not shown here. The government offers several. The first that you mentioned, Chief Judge Olson, was the use of government resources, sponsoring her on a base. The second was saying that airmen are supposed to use military property and installations for appropriate off-duty activities or morale and welfare purposes, not child pornography offenses. But that goes back to the offense itself is what we're upset about. Therefore, it's prejudicial to good order and discipline. The missing step, the key step in the analysis is, what is the impact on the military? It's not shown here. Second thing that they argue is the harm is the creation of the child pornography within the community, but that's hard to square with the fact that the military is not aware of the child pornography within the charge time frame. There's no evidence of that here. Airman Richard doesn't need this court to create any new law. It's asking for nothing more than standard legal sufficiency analysis. And on the record before this court, there is simply no evidence of a direct and palpable prejudice to good order and discipline. There is only remote and indirect prejudice, the exact type of prejudice that the president cautioned against charging at all under Article 134, Clause 1. Further, there's not as though this is creating a loophole in Article 134. This was charged only as prejudicial to good order and discipline. The government is bound by that charge and decision. They could have, and generally do, charge under Clause 2. But they're bound by the charging language here and the failure to provide any proof of the terminal element.
Counsel, you still have a few minutes to go, but I just want to check and see if Judge Sparks has any questions.
No, Chief, I don't.
Thank you, Your Honor. And barring any questions from the court, Your Honor,
there are none. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Major Brittany Spears, and together with Colonel Naomi Dennis, we represent the United States. Drawing every reasonable inference from the evidence of record in a light most favorable to the government, a rational trier of fact could have found that when appellant used his military status, his government property, and his government-owned quarters to produce, distribute, and possess child pornography, his misconduct was prejudicial to good order and discipline.
How?
Your Honor, dorm rooms, security guards, the visitation policies to come onto base, the use of property, there's a purpose for it. It's military readiness, it's military effectiveness. And when you have an individual who is contravening those procedures and misusing that property, it can diminish mission effectiveness and mission readiness.
Did it diminish military effectiveness?
Your Honor, there's no requirement that there's actually a tangible impact on good order and discipline.
Well, how is that possible? When it says prejudice to good order, do you agree that that means a negative impact on prejudice and good order?
Your Honor, the definition of prejudice is that there's some harm to good order and discipline in the
army. Okay, so here, what evidence is there in the record that there's harm to good order and discipline? Sorry, yes, to good order and discipline.
Your Honor, the fact that you have a military member who takes an oath in order to uphold standards and is not abiding by those standards can affect commission readiness.
That sounds like a per se rule that anyone in the military who commits a crime has violated good order and discipline.
No, Your Honor, every single case has to be looked at on its own facts and circumstances to determine if there's actual prejudice to good order.
Okay, so in this case, what is the evidence in the record that demonstrates harm to prejudice and good order? And prejudice, you know what I meant. So.
Yes, Your Honor. It's not that there is a tangible effect that there were sorties that couldn't be flown or that property couldn't be used for certain things. There's no tangible effect, but this court has never held that there has to be this tangible impact. In United States versus Irvin, it's a child pornography case, a possession case. And there, this court held that the possession, even though no one knew about it or that there was some sort of impact, it was still prejudicial to good order and discipline. It's helpful to look back at it.
What year is that case?
Your Honor, Irvin was... Give me just a moment, please.
Okay, so between 2008 and in 2011, there's a sea change in this court's jurisprudence in dealing with the terminal elements, right? We hold that terminal elements have to be proved, they have to be pled, that they can't be LIOs of other offenses, they can't be LIOs of each other, because there's this recognition by the court that the Constitution demands that every element of a crime be pled and proven beyond a reasonable doubt. How did that happen in this case?
Your Honor, because you had a military member who used his military status to bring a host national child onto a military installation, and then he used government property that was meant to house him to ensure his readiness for the mission in order to facilitate and commit a crime.
Okay, and where is the evidence in the record that those acts caused a harm to good order and discipline?
Your Honor, it's the government's position that a military member who cannot abide by standards...
Whoa. You're trying to push us back pre-Fosler. It's an element. Following up on Judge Hardy, it's an element. It's got to be proven by competent evidence. It cannot be implied from any particular act. That's what we used to do. And I, in reading your brief, that's exactly what you want us to do again. And you keep saying, well, he brought her on base. Well, da-da-da-da-da. Uh-uh. What did he do that prejudiced good order and discipline?
I want to be clear that the government's position is that there isn't a per se conduct that is automatic.
I'm sorry, I couldn't understand you.
Yes, Your Honor. I just want to be clear that the government's position is that there is not per se misconduct that will automatically prove the terminal element under Clause 1.
And the government is right when it asserts that, but then you turn right around and assert the opposite, or you seem to be, by saying, well, he did this. That's enough.
Your Honor, it's not that it's enough. It's that when you're looking at...
What is it about bringing her on base or whatever that prejudices good order and discipline in the sense of proving an element of the offense?
Your Honor, bringing her on base to Ramstein Air Force Base, it's as Chief Judge Olson had mentioned earlier, it's the fact that he's using the security forces members who are there to defend the installation. He is allowed to bring her on base.
Okay, now we're sliding into pulling out resources. We got security forces members over there, and they're supposed to be they're doing something, and he's using them for some other purpose.
Your Honor,
I don't get this at all.
It's the involvement of him bringing a host national teenager on base with the intent to commit a crime to produce the child pornography. But it's more than that. It's that he's using his dorm room, the privacy that his dorm room provides him, in order to produce the child pornography. So it's more than just there's production of child pornography, therefore it's per se. It's the facts and circumstances of this specific case.
Counsel, how do you distinguish the Caldwell case? That's the one that attempted suicide that the appellant brings up in the reply brief, and you didn't really have an opportunity in your brief to address that. But I think the basic point there is they used up a lot of government resources. There was testimony that people were mad at him and everything else like that, and yet we still found that there wasn't sufficient proof of a tangible impact or palpable impact of military justice. How do you distinguish Caldwell?
Yes, Your Honor. It's distinguished because in Caldwell, the use of the military resources were used to save him because he had the suicide attempt. Here, there's an actual misuse of government resources, his government-owned quarters, in order to effectuate the crime. So it's not just that a crime is committed and then resources are expended. I mean, resources are always expended, typically, if a crime's caught, because you have OSI that's investigating it. You know, you have JAGs that are litigating it. Those are things that come after the crime. So it's distinguished because in this particular case, he was using those resources in order to assist and commit in his crime. So that's how the government would distinguish it.
Can I also ask you about the Irvin case? That's the possession of child pornography. If I'm correct, that was a guilty plea, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And our opinion basically had one sentence that said the military judge inquired into it during the Providence inquiry, but we don't really know what was said. Can we really rely on that case just for the proposition that we don't have to have an actual impact on good order and discipline, given that it came up without any facts, just guilty plea?
Yes, Your Honor. I looked at that case very closely to see if they explained exactly why it's prejudicial good order and discipline. But in United States versus Going, they cite to United States versus Irving for the same proposition that nobody saw the child pornography or knew that it existed, but it's still prejudicial. And then in United States versus Caldwell, it was mentioned in a dissent that Judge Stuckey had joined in on for the same proposition. So I think the fact that this court has repeatedly cited to it to show prejudice to good order and discipline without there being that knowledge is helpful for this court.
So based on your argument, if a service member commits any crime in his barracks room or dorm room, is there a Clause 1 violation there?
Your Honor, it's not that if it's every single time that there's a crime committed in a dorm room, it's going to be prejudicial. I think every single case has to be looked at on its facts and circumstances in order to determine if it's prejudicial to good order and discipline.
But that's part of the problem I'm having. I don't see where you're providing us with any basis to distinguish and to point to the fact that, gee, he used his dorm room, he used the bed that was issued. It seems so extended from the facts here. And part of the concern, too, is obviously this court can look through the record and find information that will support. However, when we have the trial counsel in this case presented with this problem, and I don't say this to criticize, but essentially starts tap dancing and simply says that it would be, quote, ridiculous not to find it. And so the trial counsel doesn't seem to feel as if he has, in fact, introduced any evidence that would support this. Why shouldn't that give us pause in terms of our court trying to jump in and go along this theoretical route that you seem to be articulating in terms of, well, security guard personnel were involved, the dorm room or barracks room was involved. Why should we be doing that when, because it was an element, the government was required to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt?
Yes, Your Honor. Addressing the trial counsel point of your question, the trial counsel could have perhaps done a better job of articulating and pointing to which specific evidence applied to which element. But this court held in United States versus Phillips, and I understand that that is a Clause 2 analysis, but the court held there that trial counsel is not required to point out which specific pieces of evidence actually go. They just have to introduce enough evidence that is sufficient to meet the element. And that was done in this case. even if the trial counsel was inarticulate in his closing argument and by not mentioning it, and then was inarticulate in his rebuttal after the CDC brought it up.
So just to put a fine point on it, the mere fact that trial counsel in the course of this elicited testimony that she was sponsored on and it happened in the dorm room, boom, we have prejudice to good order and discipline.
Your Honor, I believe that...
Proof beyond a reasonable doubt on that point.
Yes, Your Honor. It's not just that the evidence is there, it's that when you're looking at it under a legal sufficiency standard in a light most favorable to the government, whether or not any rational trier of fact could have looked at that evidence and determined that it was prejudicial to good order and discipline. Military members who are chosen by convening authorities, they're uniquely qualified to serve as members, and they're able to look at this evidence and make a determination if it prejudices good order and discipline. Justice Blackmun and Justice Berger and Parker versus Levy in the concurrence, they said that good order and discipline is a term that is so ingrained in the mindsets of military members that its meaning is plain and timeless. So they're able to look at...
Right, but in the majority opinion in Parker v. Levy, they said the only reason Article 134 isn't unconstitutionally vague is because, in addition to custom and usage, this court had stepped in and upped the requirement from just prejudice to good order and discipline to direct and palpable prejudice to good order and discipline, and then that the president had incorporated that standard into the manual for courts martial. So that's a problem, right?
Your Honor, I think it's helpful when we're looking at the president's explanations. It's also illustrative to look at the extramarital conduct for Article 134. And the president there has said that the effect of good order and discipline, the prejudice has to be obvious, it has to be measurable, it has to be divisive, and it goes to the mission, to the unit, to morale. It's very, very specific. And that seems to be more of this tangible impact to a specific part of good order and discipline, to what it's affecting. And so this direct and palpable, when you look at the plain meaning, the definition of it, it's just whether or not there's a straightforward and easily perceptible harm to good order and discipline. And here,
but here we don't have any harm at all.
Your Honor, the harm is when you have, again, I know that I keep going back to this, a military member who is not meeting standards, but
let's shift gears for a second. Let's say the exact same evidence had been solicited in a plea colloquy in a guilty plea case, but no mention, just like here, we've got no mention of the terminal element. Would that be wouldn't we say the military judge erred in accepting that plea? Right? That would, if they failed to ask someone who's trying to plead guilty to an offense to explain to the court why their conduct was prejudicial to good order, we'd say it was error. It was reversible error. Right? So isn't it weird to say that in a case, in a contested case, where all the elements have to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt, that what happened here was okay? But if the exact same thing had happened in a guilty plea case, where the standards are so much lower, it seems, like that would have been fine? Or that would have been error?
It would not be fine. And I would argue that the standards are higher when you have an individual who's pleading guilty just because they're giving up so many of their constitutional rights.
Well, so the burden is actually higher for a military judge to accept a guilty plea than it is for the government to prove a crime in a contested case?
I just mean that an individual in that scenario is going through the plea colloquy and he's saying that he understands that every part of his misconduct actually meets an element. So there you need to make sure that member understands what he's doing. So that's what I guess maybe higher is the wrong word for it. But isn't
that the exact purpose of the notice requirement? Right? The whole reason this court said all of the terminal elements matter, they have to be pled, they have to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt, is because the Constitution requires notice to the accused, right? So the notice, the defense comes in, they're all ready to prove that regardless of what the government says on their case, that it wasn't prejudicial to good order and discipline, right? And then they wait, and the government says nothing about it. How are they supposed to rebut nothing? Like, what do you get up on the defense and say in response to, well, the government failed to put on any evidence for this element, so I guess we win? I mean, what are they supposed to say in response? Like, how does the notice requirement for them to prepare their defense work if the government doesn't have to come in and say anything?
Your Honor, the defense is put on notice when it's in the charge that it's their charging clause one, that it's prejudicial to good order and discipline. the government is not required to say that this specific piece of evidence goes to this specific element. The defense is still on notice of it. They're still able to interview witnesses. They have discovery. They're looking at all of the evidence. So they're on notice. It's just that, it's being handed to them that this is exactly the misconduct that, goes to this element. That's not required.
Well, certainly, but don't they need to come in and make some presentation about how this element has been proven beyond a reasonable doubt?
Your Honor, yes, and I believe that they did that in this case by putting on the evidence of the facts of the military status, bringing her on base, the using of the military furniture, the using of his privately owned, not privately owned, the government-owned dorm rooms. They did put that evidence on, but even still, I think when you're looking at it at the standard that we are at, this legal sufficiency, whether or not a rational trier of fact could look at the evidence that was on record in a light most favorable to the government, that element is met. They could find that it was prejudicial to good order and discipline.
I'd like to just ask one question along those lines, because I want to make sure I understand the contours of the argument. Here, when you're talking about, well, he was using government property, no one else knew this except for him, however, are you saying that it is sufficient to show that, based on the conduct of the accused, that his own conduct was, his own good order and discipline was prejudiced by his own conduct? Is that what you're arguing?
Your Honor.
And if that's so, then why wouldn't any criminal offense by a service member be a Clause 1 violation?
Yes, Your Honor. So it still depends on the facts and circumstances of each case. And this court had looked at, in United States versus Free, which was a 1988 case, but this court had said that the surrounding circumstances have more to do with making the act prejudicial than the act itself. So you still have to look at, it's not just that there was a crime that was committed. It's dependent on the facts and circumstances of that specific crime. And here, the facts and circumstances of the crime demonstrate that it was prejudicial to good order and discipline. And does that answer your question, sir?
Close enough for government work.
Okay.
Judge Sparks, there's a minute left. I just want to make sure you have an opportunity to ask any questions you may have.
Chief, I have no questions.
Okay. Any other questions from the bench? You still have
50 seconds.
Exactly.
Yes, sir. Judge Hardy, the one thing that I did want to bring up that I haven't mentioned yet is in United States versus Wilcox, where there was a constitutional implication or constitutional right that was implicated, the court held that it was still looking at whether or not there was a likelihood of this sort of prejudice to good order and discipline. So even where there was a constitutional right that was being implicated, the court wasn't looking at whether or not there was a tangible, actual effect to good order and discipline. So I think that's helpful in analyzing what is the specific harm and how much is needed to prove that harm. All right, pending any further questions, all right, the United States asks for this court to approve the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Major Bly.
Thank you, Your Honor. The government is correct that the trial counsel doesn't have to specifically point out for the members exactly how this happened. But certainly on appeal, it needs to demonstrate to this court where, within the record, there is a direct and palpable prejudice to good order and discipline. Now, the position that they've taken today is that it doesn't have to be tangible. I think the dictionary disagrees that the direct and palpable is an inescapable burden of proof on the government, and it's simply not found on the record here in this court's questions today, repeatedly asking where is the connection between the act and the harm, have no answers. What this is boiled down to is that the act itself, the government wishes the act itself to suffice to prove prejudice to good order and discipline. That's simply impermissible.
Well, counsel, I don't know that was the government's position. I think counsel specifically rejected that. She said, well, it wasn't just the act itself. It was the context. It was the use of the government resources, the location. And, for example, we didn't ask the question, what if the production had been off post, alone in an apartment, but this involved getting somebody, a foreign national, on a post and the whole circumstances. Do the circumstances matter? I think your position doesn't really have to be that the government's view is any misconduct. I think, isn't your position just simply, yeah, you have to look at the consequences, the context, but in this case, there's, it doesn't add up to any identifiable, palpable effect.
Yes, Judge Banks, and I don't mean to overstate their position. I think the point I wanted to make is that we rely only on the lack of evidence here for legal sufficiency analysis, but the natural impact of if this was found legally sufficient would be that it is really just the act itself that suffices for a direct and palpable prejudice to grow in discipline. It's the evidence that fails to bridge that gap here. So I don't mean to misstate the government's position, but I think that is with that equation of Clause 1 and Clause 2 is a problematic consequence of their position today.
And, counsel, what about counsel for the government's attempt to or argument for distinguishing Caldwell, that everything that happened after the commission of the crime? It didn't involve anything before the commission of the crime, the medical treatment, the transportation, people being upset by it. That all happened afterwards, and therefore that's what distinguishes the case.
I'm not sure that this Court has drawn a distinction when assessing what was the direct and palpable prejudice to good order and discipline. It can be, it should be, the impact of the offense often. It will be, did service members find out about it? What was their, how did that affect their perception of prejudice to good order and discipline? What was the actual impact? What resources were impacted or unavailable, readiness issues, all those things are generally going to be after the fact. It doesn't necessarily have to be wrapped up in the offense itself. It can be one of the consequences. But I think the point for our case here today, Your Honor, is that neither are shown, either the way the misconduct occurred or the after effects. None of them show a direct and palpable prejudice to good order and discipline.
And what about the Irving case?
Well, Your Honor, as this Court recently wrote, I mean, it's a guilty plea, folks, is what you said. So that's a case where there was actually a specific colloquy with the military judge about the ways that the conduct was prejudicial, good order and discipline, and was service discrediting. So it went directly into...
Do we know what they said?
Your Honor, we don't. But another point to make about Irvin is that at the time, in 2004, it was charged as a Child Pornography Protection Act Clause 3 offense. And at the time, this court could have simply held that it was sufficient as a lesser included, that it was satisfied automatically by virtue of charging it under Clause 3, that Clause 2.1 or Clause 2 were satisfied. And this court has gone away from that, but that was the landscape when Irvin was decided. It was pre-Medina, Jones, Miller, Fosler that have gone in the opposite direction.
I see that your time has expired. Any questions from my colleagues? Thank you. Case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court is adjourned until further order of the court.
All rise.